Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Later in the hour, we have Ernie Goss talking about the economy, Ken Delfino talking about the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. But we start out our hour today by talking about how beginning 2017 with nothing more than a pen and a notebook could change your year. Our guest is Kay Adams. She's founder and director of the Center for Journal Therapy in Denver, Colorado. She is a best-selling author, speaker, psychotherapist, and she's a pioneer in the field of therapeutic writing. Her first book, Journal to the Self, is a classic that has helped define the field of journal therapy. And through the Therapeutic Writing Institute, she trains students all over the world to help become journaling facilitators and therapists. Kay Adams joins us from Denver, Colorado. Kay, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you, Lori. It's wonderful to be with you.
Been a longtime fan of your work, so I'm excited to talk with you and sort of share some of that work with folks in South Dakota. So thank you again. And let's start with the fact that a lot of people have something of an idea of what a journal is, but do they really know how to use it most effectively, do you find?
Well, you know, journaling of any type, and I define journaling and diary writing as essentially the same thing. It's keeping a record of your day, of your thoughts, feelings, what you did, how you felt about it, what you're struggling with, what you're celebrating, any sort of life record. And it doesn't have to be formal. It doesn't have to be written in by hand in a book. It can be on the computer or on your phone. There's a lot of really good journaling apps out there. And I think for the most part, there are, you know, limited exceptions, but for the most part, any kind of writing is useful, and you don't really need to know how, but there are some things that are helpful to help people get started and to get the most out of it, I think. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about that today.
Well, we're going to talk about some of those basic techniques in just a second, but I'm wondering first how much this field has really changed over the years as more research that you've really, a lot of the research coming from the Center for Journal Therapy and people who are affiliated with it. How have you sort of seen it transform from a research perspective?
From a research perspective, we have just boomed. And when I started teaching writing, journal writing in 1985, which is 32 years ago this year, there wasn't really very much published at all. There were only six books that had been written about journal writing that were in print. But James Pennebaker, a psychologist at the University of Texas at Austin, was doing some research studies on the use of writing as a tool for emotional release and even, as they found out, stress management, better stress management. And his work was just starting to get published in 1985-86. But he is the one who is responsible for the evidence-based research we have that demonstrates that writing about emotionally difficult material, or even about anything, I mean, it works perfectly the same if you're writing about extremely positive material, but they started the studies with people who were under a lot of emotional stress. When they wrote about the traumatic experience or the highly stressful experience in a way that was structured over a period of only 4 days, at the end of the test, they found that people really did show higher immune system functioning, better control of blood pressure, better respiration, a lot of health outcomes as well as emotional, behavioral health outcomes. And the Pennebaker research has become the cornerstone for everything that we know scientifically about that aspect of writing. There have since been many other studies that have taken this into other domains. So the last 30 years has been enormous in that we started from ground zero and have built into a credible body of scientific work and evidence. We at the Center for Journal Therapy do much more qualitative research than quantitative research. We don't do actual statistical tests. We observe people over time and process, and the anecdotal research that we have evidences that people who write journals in a purposeful and intentional way have very measurable, in their own lifetimes, positive outcomes. Hmm.
Let's go to some of those basics then. So where do you begin? Obviously, you got to get a notebook or an app, yeah. I guess.
Yeah. A notebook, an but app.
Is that true, though, as an app? Is that going to be as effective? Is there value in sitting with pen and paper and actually writing?
Well, yes and yes.
Okay.
There is value in an app, absolutely. I did a study with Nathan Oren and Brenda Hudson a couple of years ago on a 30-day digital journaling challenge, and we wrote a paper about it. It's on my website, journaltherapy.com. Anybody can download it. But it demonstrated that there's no effective difference between how people feel at the end of a write if they're writing by hand or writing with an app. So people who are inclined to what the study really reinforced for me, I was surprised by the consistency in the results, but what it reinforced for me is that for people who are on the fence and thinking, well, I might write a journal, but I just don't think I can sit down and do it by hand, by all means, do it on a keyboard.
Right.
There is no negative outcome to writing on a keyboard as opposed to writing by hand. There may, however, be a slightly more positive outcome writing by hand because the connection between, I mean, I just love the mind-body connection that happens when my thoughts are coming down my arm and out my pen and onto a page where I can actually touch them and have relationship with them. That's really important to me. And I'm an old-school journaler. I started out, you know, with a spiral notebook and a ballpoint pen when I was 10 years old. And so, you know, that's just my preference. But it's equally effective to do it by computer, so I don't discourage anyone from doing that. The first thing, you know, if we start with the very basics, you can start with a unit of time. I like to use a technique that I call the 5-minute sprint, which is exactly what it sounds like. Set your timer for 5 minutes, think about what you want to write about, or just start writing, and write as fast as you can without thinking, without editing, without going back and rereading for 5 minutes, and then stop. If you want to renegotiate with yourself and write for another 2 or 3 or 5 minutes, that's fine. But the whole point of the 5-minute sprint is that you can teach yourself that you can get some stuff done in 5 minutes. And 5 minutes, there's nothing magical about it other than it's a pretty universally agreed upon unit of time that people can manage.
Sure.
People say, oh, I don't have time to write a journal. And I say, well, do you think you might find 5 minutes twice this week? And they usually will say yes. So, yeah.
Does it matter what you sit and talk about for that first 5 minutes? If you're just, are you at this point? I guess what I'm wondering is, are you trying to build a habit, or are you trying to address a certain topic?
You're trying to. I think at this point you're trying to introduce yourself to a new acquaintance. For people who haven't ever written before, you don't know how it's going to be. So it's just like, hey, journal, here I am. Here are the things that I think I might want to, or what's going on is a great question. What's going on for me right now?
Sure.
That's a question that I can always start with, and 5 minutes later, I know much more clearly what's going on for me, or how am I feeling,
right?
Or what's the most important thing to do today? These are all things that will help you get started, but for people who are very, very first starting out, really what you're doing is just exploring and finding out what happens when I, you know, write about this or what I write about that. There's no real agenda. But it is, you raised an important point, Lori. It is important to have, for maximum benefit, it's important to have some sort of consistency. And that consistency truly can be once a week for 10 minutes.
Sure. Sure. Now,
or once a month.
You mentioned starting when you were 10 with a notebook. I think I started with a little Hello Kitty diary, and I was really afraid my mom was going to read it. And she's a very nice person, so I don't know where that came from.
Yeah.
I'm not sure she would have read
my
diary. But what about this whole notion of if I write it down, it's possible that somebody else is going to find it, and that might affect my honesty.
Yeah, it absolutely does. And I like you, I started out with a little 5-year diary, too. that lasted about 6 months, and then I graduated to Big Chief tablets. But the privacy question is a huge one. And I like to start every new volume, whether it's a spiral notebook or a yellow tablet or whatever it happens to be, one of those beautiful books that we all get for Christmas, or that I do anyway. I like to leave a title page, you know, the first page that it opens to. I just don't start writing on that page. I leave that for a title page, and my title page always, you know, it might say Kay's Journal, January 1st, 2017 through, and then I'll fill in the exit date later. But I always underneath that put, this is my personal journal. Please respect my privacy. Don't read it. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And then on the next page, I write, as I was saying, this is my personal journal. Don't read it without my permission. Thank you. Yeah. And then if somebody's going to turn two pages that ask them not to read it and read it, that's on them, right. Not me. And it doesn't mean that, and then I always keep my journal in a place where other people aren't going to stumble on it.
Sure.
Inside the briefcase that I carry or the book bag that I carry or my backpack or in a drawer. I live alone now, but when I was living with other people, I was always mindful about just putting it someplace where people weren't going to stumble on it. And have conversations. You know, I have had roommates who I have said, you know, I write a journal and this is what it looks like. If I leave it lying around, would you please just leave it alone? Hmm. And they all say yes. But when people don't live with people who are, some people say if I started to write a journal, I would, and told my family about it, they would immediately wait until I left the house and then they would hunt it down.
And you're living with the wrong people.
If that's the case, then maybe you need to do, a locking filing cabinet or...
Sure. Take some extra measures to ensure that.
But privacy is really important.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment, South Dakota Public Broadcasting. My guest is Kay Adams. She's founder, she's director of the Center for Journal Therapy. You can find them online. Her book, Journal to the Self, is a classic over the years that sort of helped define the field of journal therapy. And Kay, I'm wondering if you go back and reread what you've written once you sort of establish the privacy and the habit of spending some time with a journal. Do you go back and mine it for information later, or do you write it and then move on?
I actually do go back and mine it for information, and I often do that in the moment, and I invite other people to do that too. This is a process that we call the reflection write, and it consists of writing spontaneously or thoughtfully or however you write. There's no right or wrong way to do it. And then at the end of the write, going back, reading what you've written, and giving yourself just a little statement of reflection. As I read this, I notice, or I'm surprised by, or I'm curious about, or I wonder about, and just see how that harvests insight. Very often, because the journal is such a present tense document, we just turn the page and go on because there's another present tense moment to be recorded. And when we don't go back and read what we've written and sit with it for a minute, we lose all of the gems that are hidden between the lines. Mm-hmm. You know, when you read something, it might immediately come clear to you that there was one really big thing you left out. Didn't even cross your mind in that 5 minutes or 10 minutes. And that's just interesting to notice. I don't, it doesn't necessarily mean anything, or maybe it does, but there's a lot that can be harvested in the moment. I also think it's a good idea. I save, these days I'm writing in spiral notebooks. I'm kind of back to the basics. Mm-hmm. So I'm writing in 70-page notebooks. I save the last 5 or 6 pages of every notebook. I just sort of put an X at the top of the page where a page number would be. And that's my signal that it's time to... wrap this one up and start a new journal. Then I go back and kind of read the whole volume and make some notes about, did I make some progress in this area? Am I still stuck in this area? What did I forget about already?
So you could go back and sort of see yourself saying the same thing over and over again about something you want to change, but you haven't. And then is that the area
years.
Years. When do you know that you need help or that you we mentioned before, sort of some traumatic, you know, mental health, sort of more behavioral health, you know, beyond the basics of journaling. When could you get yourself in trouble in the sense that you start writing things of a previous trauma that, you know, maybe come up while you're writing that you're not ready to deal with?
Yes, that can happen. And I think the signal for that is, if it happens spontaneously, if you're just writing about something that's bugging you and all of a sudden you're associating that with something from the past that feels unhealed or unresolved or scary, then that's a real signal to just be real gentle and go slow and kind of sit with it. Short, structured writes are the more you can contain a difficult experience in the writing process, the more manageable it's going to be. So to really intentionally write for 5 or 10 minutes and then walk away and then come back later. But if it starts to feel scary or dangerous, that's when you want to reach out and see if there's, you know, some help that you might seek in the form of a counselor, a spiritual director, a good friend that you can run it by, some sort of reality check process so that people can, you know, and as a therapist who specializes in writing as a tool for healing, growth, and change, I have a whole protocol about how to keep writing safe when you're working with difficult material. The essence of it is structure and containment, to write very quickly, in small units, and to pace yourself in a way that does not feel, you know, so that it feels manageable. If it starts feeling unmanageable, I strongly encourage people to not necessarily write about it, but instead to see if they can find a way of getting some support.
My guest is Kay Adams. She's the founder director of the Center for Journal Therapy. It's in Denver, Colorado. One of her many books is called Journal to the Self. You can find all kinds of more content on their website and in that book with different prompts and a journal ladder, which is fascinating. So I just want to say thank you, Kay, for joining us today. And tell us the website where people can find more, please, before we let you go.
Journaltherapy.com.
Well, thanks for being here, Kay. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Lori. I appreciate it.
Coming up after the break, Ken Delfino is from Keystone. He's going to talk to us about his experiences in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive. You're in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. January 31st, 1968 is one of many days that Ken Delfino will never forget. Ken is a veteran of the United States Navy. He's with us today to talk about combat experiences during the Tet Offensive with the Navy's River Patrol Force in South Vietnam. From his home in Keystone, South Dakota, via telephone, Ken Delfino, welcome to In the Moment.
Well, thank you, Lori, and thank you for having me on.
You remember this as if it were yesterday. How much do you remember just from the day that this happened compared to other days during your time in Vietnam? Does this one stand out just because of the intensity of the experience for you?
Pretty much. It's something that's just indelible from the first rounds that started until that first 24-hour period. It was just pretty incredible. And you probably ask any Vietnam veteran who went through a Tet, who's province capital went through the Tet attack, will probably tell you the same thing. Mm-hmm. But we were different. Everybody had their own differences. You know, the Navy far different from what the Army went through at Ia Drang and what the Marines went through at Hawaii City and Khe Sanh. We'll have our stories, but it's the intensity. There are certain things that you just won't forget.
River Patrol Force, tell us what that means. Help us figure out what you were doing before this day.
Well, before this day, when I first joined, I was on a cargo ship, and during one of our three trips over, we dropped off some Marines at a village at Tam Kỳ, which is up in the north and in the northern part of South Vietnam. As we were leaving, the Marines came under fire. We could hear it. I wanted to go back to help, but we couldn't. That was not our mission. Our mission was to go back to the ship and bring more supplies back to these Marines who needed them. Mm. So I said, this is not, I'm not doing my share. And I heard about the SWIFT boats, so I put in transfer requests for SWIFT boats. I'd never got it. And then a new organization in May of 66 started up, would start up earlier, but they needed volunteers for a group called the River Patrol Force. And their job was to interdict enemy traffic in the Mekong Delta and the rivers and the canals of the Mekong Delta, and to protect the underside and the western approaches to Saigon from the Mekong Delta. So I joined that group. It took about, let's see, that was, training started in June of 66, and I finished in September. We reported to Vietnam to our base, and we started patrolling rivers in October. Different areas. Our boats were like 31-foot fiberglass boats, which were converted from a cabin cruiser designed by a company up in Seattle. Mm. And they just converted it to a little heavily armed moving platform, 31 by 10 feet wide, which had very heavy armament, very little protection, but we relied on speed for our maneuver to get away from trouble.
Was that effective?
Most of the cases, yes, in the early parts up until about 1969, right, when our boats were moved over closer to the Cambodia border. It was pretty effective, but fiberglass doesn't stop very much stuff.
No,
we did have quarter-inch steel plating around coxswain drove the boat, and also on the deck. But mostly, armor plating got in the way a lot more than it helped. And a lot of times, the rockets, when they set off the armor plating, they send more shrapnel all over. I was fortunate that my boats never got hit by rockets. Mm. We get dinged by small arms fire, but not by rockets, because that caused a lot of damage.
How old are you when you arrive in country?
In country, I'm 21.
And so, give me an idea. Take me back to the United States before you get to Vietnam, and when did you first really hear about the country? And did you have an idea what you were getting into?
No. All I knew is that after JFK was assassinated in 63. That was another memorable day in our lives. Wanted to do something, and I just felt the following semesters in 64 that I needed to be doing something else. So I joined the Navy, and while I was in boot camp was when the Tonkin Gulf incident happened, mm-hmm. and Edward Alvarez was shot down, and he was a graduate of my high school at the time, Salinas High School in California.
Oh.
And so that, you know, kicks in another motivation for you to do something. But, you know, it wasn't from 64 until 66 that I got over there. No, I didn't know what I was getting into. We weren't, when I was on the ship, we really didn't follow politics. We just did our jobs. And it's a lot different today because of the Internet and a lot of other things. Our troops today are far more, I feel, far more informed, well-informed than I was when I went overseas.
Mm. So January 31st, 1968, take me there. Take me to the night before and tell me what's happening the night before, because this one of the sort of hallmarks of this event is how unexpected it is. So take me to the night before and tell me where you're at and what you're doing that night.
Well, the night before, I was in Mito, which is pronounced Mito, which is the province capital of Dinh Thuong province, which is about 40 miles south west of Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the first major river crossings. At that time, there are no bridges. Nowadays, there are bridges across all those rivers, getting there through the Delta a lot faster. I was at it was the evening of the Tet celebration for the Vietnamese Lunar New Year, and there was a Filipino medical detachment in town that I'd become friends with, and so several of us were over at their villa having, you know, home-cooked Filipino meals, which I hadn't had in a long time.
Some cheese lumpia there.
I'm sorry?
Cheese lumpia. That's my favorite.
Oh, lumpia, adobo.
Right? Well, now we're going to get distracted, so let's go back to the...
And plenty of Sammy Go beer.
Yes.
But anyways, we stayed and we partied, and then the next day, that was my night off, and mm-hmm. The next morning I had day patrol to go on. So we were in our barracks. When about 5 o'clock, I think 4 or 5 o'clock, we heard mortars dropping in, and that was usually, we expected it every, you know, once a month, twice a month, you know, one of the local VCs would go out, put his tube up and drop about 4 or 5 mortars, and it would disappear, and they would drop all over town. They weren't zeroed in anywhere.
Mm.
these were closer to us. And then after the fifth or sixth one, I said, wait a minute, what's going on? I started to kind of wake up a little bit. And I was kind of hungover, actually. and I didn't want to get up. They scrambled the boats. My crew just decided to put up the mattresses up against a window in case anything hit close to us, to absorb any shrapnel. And then next thing I hear is small arms fire. And we never heard of small arms fire in the city before. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of it. I said, this is not unusual. And that woke me up. So I get over. It's still like dark. It's 5:30 in the morning. And go over to our headquarters, find out what's going on. Turned out we found out that all the province headquarters, capital, had been hit, the entire country, so something was up. And gunfire was heavy all over town, different directions. Unbeknownst to us, because we were 180 sailors in Metaw, is our river division, there was an army, a Vietnamese Army Ranger battalion, and there was a Vietnamese 7th Infantry Division battalion, and then we had a SEAL team also, and they had reacted quickly to secure the perimeters of the town, but unbeknownst to us, we were being attacked by what turned out to be 1,200 Viet Cong. So they did a good job of keeping them a little ways away from us, to where they got to about two blocks of our headquarters. My job at that point.
How much of this do you learn from history after the fact? Almost.
Well, it wasn't until 1969 when I wrote a book called Tet by a fellow by the name of Don Oberdorfer. We found out that the president, President Chiu, was in Metaw visiting with his daughter. We had no idea that he was in town. Yeah, and security probably would have been a lot different had we known that. But then that wasn't the Navy's job. That was, you know, the Vietnamese Army and the Rangers. Because they're president. I ended up being a shotgun driver on our delivery, on our crew pickup truck, because our headquarters and barracks were around the corner from each other, and we were maybe, I think, five or six blocks from the piers. And so he needed a shotgun driver, so I rode shotgun for him all day.
Okay. So how about the Filipinos then? Did you know where they were at? You had just been with them? You cared about them?
Well, they... It was about 10 o'clock in the morning or so, I decided to go over to the province hospital to see how they were doing, and we found out that half the team was still at the villa. They had a villa out at an area we call the Y, which is where the highway comes in from Saigon, Highway 4. And it veered, and the road went straight, and then it also veered to the right to go right straight down to the riverfront without going through town. So that's where their villa was, and it was past the area where the Vietnamese had guarded, which they had cordoned off. Mm-hmm. The Viet Cong come in pretty close, but then the Arvin and the Ranger just shoved them back to about half a mile or a mile away from where they their deepest penetration. But the villa was still out at the Y, which was in kind of a no man's land. So I found out that the other half of the team was still there, because their duty was half of the medical detachment would stay at the hospital. In an attack, they would go to the hospital. The other half of the team would stay at home. Mm-hmm. And the other half of the team never was able to get out of their villa. Hmm. So we found out, got a couple of guys who said, "Yo, I'll go help you." And we went out and we got the team out on a couple of trips. And we saw what the devastation was beyond that point. The disappointing thing is the Vietnamese would not give us any cover. They wouldn't go out there with us because they didn't want to risk losing any of their vehicles or their men. So we were kind of like on our own out there, but we were fairly heavily armed to go out there and find them. And we did find them. There were a lot of Vietnamese civilians in their bunker, but in the villa itself, two nurses and two sergeants were in there, and we had to go back a second time because apparently when we loaded up the vehicles, one of the sergeants decided to go back upstairs and destroy the radios, and we left them behind, not knowing that he had gone back up. You know, one truck thought the other guy had him. So we had to go back, get him.
To go back and pick somebody up.
And it was eerie, but this time, after the Vietnamese saw it, we didn't, you know, draw any fire the first time. They went in with us to help get them, and then we got them back safely.
And I'm not chuckling because it's funny at all. It's quite a story, and one thing after another with all the chaos happening. If you're just tuning in, my guest is Ken Delfino. He's going to speak this Saturday, 9 a.m. at Ellsworth Air Force Base, the South Dakota Air and Space Museum. That's a free event. It's sponsored by the Black Hills Veterans Writing Group. We're really only touching a little bit of his story here. So you can come see him this Saturday in person at 9 o'clock there and hear the rest of this really compelling story. Ken, I just want to, one last question before we let you go, and that's just how important is it, do you think, for Vietnam veterans to really share their stories at this point in our country's history as well?
I think it's pretty important. There was a teacher, her name was Lindy Poling, and back in North Carolina. She created a program called Lessons of Vietnam, where she paired up a student, a senior, with a Vietnam veteran of, you know, different branches. She did this program from 2002 to when she retired in 2011. And I was fortunate to have been part of that program, and I still have contact with some of my links from those years. Mm. The kids asked the same questions of 50 veterans, of their veterans, and the veterans, didn't matter which branch, they were different branches. The stories were different, but the feelings were very similar, even though they weren't worded the same. So we were scattered all over the country. We covered 15 years of the war and all five branches of the service.
Wow.
So that just shows, the questions the kids had opened up a lot of doors, and it made it easier to talk every year. And the following year, another door would be opened. So, yeah, it's got to be passed on to the next generation. There is Texas Tech University has a Vietnam Studies group that they put together down there, and there's a lot of good information out there in books. There's a lot of books that are bad, but there's some very good ones, including one called "Whitewash, Blackwash: The Myths of Vietnam," which clears up a lot of myths that are out there.
Ken Delfino, you can see him this Saturday. He's from Keystone. He'll be at 9 o'clock at the Ellsworth Air Force Base's South Dakota Air and Space Museum, talking about his time in Vietnam, especially during the Tet Offensive. Ken, thank you so much for being with us and just sharing a part of your story. We hope to have you back.
Thank you, Lori, for asking me and recognizing our efforts.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
And when we come back, we talk economics with Ernie Goss. He's a professor of economics at Creighton University. You're in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Ernie Goss is a professor of economics at Creighton University. Dr. Goss is essentially the master of all things financial. He's here to discuss the economic outlook for 2017. He joins us today via telephone from Omaha, Nebraska. Ernie, welcome to In the Moment.
Well, thanks, Lauren. Thanks for that generous remark. Good to be with you.
Well, you're talking to someone who can just sort of barely balance her checkbook. So some of these sort of larger concepts are fascinating to me, but sometimes out of reach. So I'm hoping you can you could help me along here as we get going.
Well, it may scare you, but I have a tough time with balancing my checkbook as well. So
makes me feel all so much better now.
Okay.
So 2017, we're looking at a new president. We're thinking what that sort of means for us in the Midwest for ag prices, free trade. Where do you want to begin today talking about what's sort of the thing that most Midwesterners are thinking about right now regarding
the
economy?
Well, Laurie, I think we do two surveys each month, both surveys, bank CEOs and purchasing managers. Both of them include South Dakota, include agricultural sector, this part of the nation, which is, of course, heavily biased or concentrated with agriculture. And both are telling the same thing. Things are less negative than they were. In other words, still not as positive as we'd like to see. Ag prices, for example, agricultural commodity prices, still about at least 15% to 20% below what we'd like to see going forward. So 2017 is shaping up better than 16, but still not as strong as we'd like to see, Lori.
Is that part of an overall pattern, or is it a change?
It is sort of a pattern. And what's going on here is the value of the dollar is increased, and that tends to put downward pressure on ag prices. Now, why is the value of the dollar increasing? Because our interest rates relative to other central banks across the globe are higher and moving even higher. So that gap between our interest rates and, say, the central bank of Europe is widening, which tends to put upward pressure on the value of the dollar and downward pressure on agricultural commodity prices. Likewise, some of our trading partners aren't doing quite as well as we'd like to see. And then you tack on that some of the noise, I'll call it noise, coming out of Washington saying we need to slap our trading partners around. And that's a little scary for those of us who depend heavily on agriculture, or I should say trade. And trade, of course, agriculture depends heavily on trade.
So let's go there for a little bit. Certainly, President-elect Donald Trump campaigned talking about some of the trade deals he thought were ineffective and bad deals from the Obama administration. And that did make some farmers and producers somewhat nervous. So do you think that is, sort of, I don't want to say just talk, but how do you think that will really play out in a policy standpoint, and how could that affect us?
Well, I hope it's a negotiating strategy. I hope his bite is not as bad as his bark, because the bark is really concerning most economists. Now, we didn't fare very well recently. Most economists, we're not the favored group right now, for sure, because most of us see trade as a win-win, not a zero sum. In other words, zero sum where we gain and someone else loses. The idea that somehow you can export to another country and then say, well, we're not going to import your goods, doesn't work that way. In other words, we export to them and we also import their goods, and we both win. I mean, we can grow, if we wish to, if with enough subsidies, we can grow bananas in South Dakota, but it doesn't make a lot of sense economically speaking. We need to import them.
So much of this conversation, though, has to do with what's a fair deal, though, and what is it a win-win based on, tariffs and things like that? How does that all factor in?
Well, I think it is a win-win. In other words, right now, I think now there is cheating, no doubt about that, and that has to be addressed. Now, that would be the intellectual property. And for example, there are movies distributed, our movies, U.S. movies produced, generated here, that are being distributed globally and not paying they've been stolen. That needs to be addressed. There's no doubt about it. But the problem is, if you start slapping tariffs on you, could begin a trade skirmish, which could become a trade war. And we know who gets hurt first in a trade war. It's usually agriculture. So that's my concern for this part of the country and my concern for the U.S.
Give me a historical basis for that, of a trade war. What did it look like in the past in a different administration, and how did it affect us?
Well, I'm going to go back a long ways here.
Okay.
That would be back to the Carter administration. Remember, we didn't go to the Olympics because of the Russians. And we had a trade war with them where we shut off sales of wheat to Russia. Mm-hmm. Well, that hurt them, but it also hurt us, and it hurt agriculture. And you remember, now I'm not saying this is what caused the downturn in agriculture in the 80s, but it sure didn't help.
Mm. Rural versus urban America. We've talked a lot about that on this show, and some of the different opinions and different needs and different voting trends of rural America versus what's happening in some of the more urban areas. What do current economic indicators point to in that regard?
Absolutely, Laurie, and that's what we're seeing in our surveys, both surveys showing that the urban areas, and that's true in South Dakota, it's true in North Dakota and right down the middle of the country, Minnesota, right down to Oklahoma and Arkansas in the South, all that. The urban areas are doing much better than the rural areas. Rural areas, because of their heavy dependence on agriculture, their heavy dependence on energy, and also agriculture, of course, that's where the real issues are, and the rural areas are not doing nearly as well. And as we know, when we look at the rural voters, they said throw the rascals out, and that's how they voted, and that has a lot to do with economics. Things aren't going as well for rural areas.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Dr. Ernie Goss. He's a professor of economics at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, and he's sort of helping me walk through some of the basics of economics. What kind of things do we look for in 2017 as just a basic consumer, or basic citizen, voter? What are the big things that I'm watching for from a public policy standpoint that really are going to affect my life?
Right, and you can look for them in January away. Look for inflation, January the 18th. If we see more inflation out there coming out, that would be the CPI, Consumer Price Index. Watch for interest rates to begin rising. So if you're a consumer out there, or even a business person, now is probably the best time to borrow. Interest rates are not likely to move lower. They're more likely to move higher. So that's what we're looking for. We're looking for jobs to continue to grow. We need to see, but it's mostly for skill workers. Right now there's a shortage, believe it or not, even in rural areas, of skilled workers. That would be the electricians, that would be the plumbers, that would be the welders that we need to see out there. And that's what we're seeing as well. So things are looking pretty good for 2017, but that means higher inflation but higher interest rates as our Federal Reserve gets concerned about an overheated economy and begin raising rates when they meet next time on January the 27th. I don't expect a rate hike then, but I expect another rate hike in the first quarter of this year.
When we talk about this sometimes, and I listen to the news in the financial sector, I feel sort of like I'm just a leaf on the water going along. Are there things that we can do as small business owners or as citizens to sort of participate in this? Or are we just really responding to sort of those big indicators and mm-hmm. trying to manage our own lives accordingly?
All right. Well, I think right now I think if you're needing capital or needing to borrow, I think today's time to borrow. Don't wait. Mortgage rates are likely to head higher in this year. If you're wanting to buy that house, there are good inventories out there right now of houses for sale. Now's a good time to be buying houses. Prices are going to continue to grow. We've seen housing prices grow at about 5 to 6% year over year. So that's what we're seeing. I do think the stock market's getting a little ahead of itself, meaning there's a little too much exuberance there for my comfort. In other words, the stock market, the value of the stock or the price of the stock relative to the fundamentals, the earnings of the companies, are a bit too high for me. Now I'm not necessarily the person to turn to for investment advice.
Right. So we talked with our South Dakota congressional representatives this past week, and one of the top things on some of their lists for the Republicans coming into the new administration was tax reform. And what are some of the things that we need to be looking at in that regard as Republicans roll out new tax reform packages?
A great question, Laurie, and that's going to happen. We're going to have a reduction in the permanent cut. Now that would be the permanent tax, but here's what's first going to happen. We're going to have a cut on in corporate tax rates for earnings overseas. In other words, when those earnings in Europe are brought home to the U.S., we now tax at 35%. So they're leaving those earnings over there. $2 to $3 to $4 trillion in earnings that are being held in foreign banks, for example. So those are going to be brought home, and that they're going to tax at, say, 15, maybe as low as 15, maybe as low as 10% on those corporate earnings. Now, what's done with those earnings that are brought home? Typically, they'll pay dividends. We'll see that happening. We'll see stock buybacks. We'll also, unfortunately, see an increase in payments to the management and leaders of the companies. Now, what will this do to the agricultural sector in this part of the country? It will tend to push up the value of the dollar and tend to, again, push down agricultural, or at least put somewhat of a lid on agricultural commodity prices.
Hmm. So. All right. What else? What else do we not understand that we need to be?
It is complex.
I'm learning a lot, though, Ernie. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Now, one other thing, of course, Dodd-Frank is one of the issues where that really affects South Dakota. There's a lot of, there's in the bank, the financial sector in South Dakota has been, I'll use a real good economic term, blistering. There's been a heck of a lot of growth in South Dakota's financial sector based upon the idea, I think perhaps correct, that we're going to have see some changes in Dodd-Frank and put less of an onerous burden on our banking sector. Also look for, of course, don't need economists to tell you this, of course, is the Affordable Care Act changes there, but that's going to be a lot tougher there. That's the tough, I wouldn't want to have to be there to do any new changes to the Affordable Care Act. That's a toughie.
How come?
Well, it's because we've expanded, you know, we've added 20 million individuals that get health insurance. Now, how do you take them off the rolls? It's almost impossible. We're now covering pre-existing illnesses. How do you turn that clock back? In other words, all these benefits that individuals have been getting, that's very difficult without, and we've got the taxes in there as well. For example, an increase in capital gains tax on higher income individuals. That's probably going to stay. Taxes on medical equipment manufacturers. That's probably going to stay. So how do you really change this and really get the cost down? Because the costs have really gone up for those individuals that already had health insurance.
What's the potential impact of rolling that back too quickly or without a plan to sort of shore up what happens next?
Very dangerous, of course, taking these individuals off the roll without putting them out there without insurance. But I'll tell you what's also dangerous, dangerous is probably too strong a word, is the hospitals have been getting increased revenue because they're now collecting from patients that were not paying. So that's a real toughie. You know, these rural hospitals, rural community clinics, also they've been benefiting from the Affordable Care Act by collecting from patients that were formerly stiffing them on their bills, not paying their bills.
So why is it so expensive? Why is healthcare so expensive?
I have to say, we economists said this. In other words, there's no way of bringing 20 million individuals on the rolls without somebody paying on the insurance I'm speaking of. And now we're paying for it. And the question is, do we want to continue? And there are lots of folks just saying, well, it's worth it. And some are saying, no, it's not worth it. And that's a political question. And I'm certainly, I have a tough enough time with economics, let alone politics. And always, Laura, you know, when politics and economics collide, usually politics wins and economics loses. And that's particularly true in trade area.
So from a fundamental perspective, somebody has to pay for it, though.
That's right.
If you're going to roll out a plan of that comprehensive nature, the cost gets spread to someone, and that includes all of us.
That's right. As Milton Friedman, the economist, Nobel Prize winner, said, there are no free lunches.
Our guest is Ernie Goss. He's a professor of economics at Creighton University in Omaha. He's helping me figure out all these things that I've always wanted to ask somebody, such as why does healthcare cost so much? I know it's a really smart question there, isn't it, Ernie?
Well, it is, but, you know, we have the best health care on the face of the earth, and it's odd. We question, we pay the most for a higher ed, college education. No one says we're over, you know, we use that as evidence that we have a good system. We're paying so much money, it's got to be good. Well, in the health care area, we're saying we're paying too much. Well, we're also getting the best care on the face of the earth. So, you know, in other words, rolling that back is tough. It's tough when you have an aging population. So those of us who are baby boomers, and I'm one of them, we're moving into that group that's going to require more health care and increase demand. When you increase demand, prices tend to go up.
Ernie Goss, thank you so much for your time. Come back and talk to us some more in the future. We appreciate you.
Well, thank you, Laura. Thanks for having me on.
All right. We'll be back with hour two of In the Moment right after a quick break and the news. You're listening to South Dakota Public Broadcasting.